For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, so for those of you who don't know me, my name's Doug. I go here to Xenos. About a little over 7 years ago, I started leading in our student ministry here. And about a year ago, I came on staff. And I remember the first time that I started discipling or mentoring a guy, things went really well, like pretty much right off the bat. Like within a year and a half, this guy was discipling someone himself. He was leading one of our high school groups here. And I remember thinking, I'm pretty good at this. I think I might have this thing down. But then as time went on, God started to humble me. And I realized that I didn't know as much as I thought I did. And I wasn't nearly as good as I thought I was. I started to either mentor guys or lead in home churches where there were guys who it just seemed like they weren't firing on all cylinders. It seemed like they could be doing more for God and to me and to a lot of my friends, maybe that they should be doing more for God. And it was something where I feel like for a long time now, I've sort of been banging my head against the wall trying to figure out how do you get someone who's not moving forward, especially a guy, how do you get a guy who's not moving forward to try and grow with God? How do you do that? And I want to be up front, there is no magic formula that we'll talk about here today. What we're going to talk about here today, I want this to be super practical. These are things either I've tried and worked. A lot of these things were things that I learned by making a mistake and realizing, oh, well, that didn't work. Or things that I kind of stole from my friends. My guess is I'm not alone and that to some of you guys, some of these things might sound familiar. My friend is really struggling to lead his marriage. It could be a guy who is having a hard time emotionally connecting with his wife. His wife's like, I just always feel really distant from him. It's like he's not fully there. He's not fully engaging me. Maybe it's the guy who like he just kind of wants his wife to do everything. He's lazy, doesn't like serve around the house. Or maybe when those times come where he needs to take a stand to his wife or to his kids, he won't do it. It's kind of a pushover. The dude I'm discipling is just going through the motions. You know, it's that guy where like you guys meet together, you talk about spiritual things, but there just really isn't that fizz or that zeal, that follow through. They come to your meetings, they might speak up and share a couple things during discussion. They're generally well behaved. But if you were to really ask yourself, is this guy lighting up the world for the kingdom of God and on a smaller scale in our home church? Not really, at least much beyond the norm. And then this one, this guy can't sustain a drive to serve people. The key word there, sustain. You talk about it. You have these like one-on-one, heart-to-heart conversations, and you talk about it, and you really come out of it optimistic that maybe that was the time where he actually will take it to heart, and he actually will move forward, and he'll actually change. And sometimes there's even some response, some initial response for the first few weeks or maybe a month or two, but then not that much farther down the road, things have sort of regressed to the norm. And one of the things that's so maddening about this is that sometimes they're people who when you look at them, you're like, I would kill to have your skill set. Like, I would kill to have some of the giftings that you have. And you look at this guy and you're like, man, this guy has so much potential. If he really just caught fire, he could do so much. And then 2 years down the road, you're sitting there and you're like, man, this guy has so much potential that he really still hasn't tapped into yet. And so Christians have tried to point the finger at a lot of different generations, trying to figure out, okay, which generation was it that turned men passive? Was it the hippies? Is it the millennials? Who's to blame? The thing is, when you look in the Bible, it's something that it happened a long time ago. Larry Crabb, in his book, The Silence of Adam, has this part where he's talking about how he feels like Eve gets an unfair rap for taking all the blame for eating the forbidden fruit. He asks this question, he says, where was Adam when the serpent tempted Eve? The Bible says that after Eve was deceived by Satan, she took some of the forbidden fruit and she ate it. She also gave some to her husband who was with her and he ate it. Was Adam there the whole time? Was he standing right next to his wife while the serpent tricked her with his cunning? Was he there listening to every word? So he was there. but he didn't engage the problem. Crabb talks about that a lot in his book, that men will see a problem, but they won't engage it. It's like some of you guys here might have like that roommate where it's like they're very observant and they see that someone's struggling, but they don't actually dive in and try and do something about it. Might be a guy who sees that there's some tension in his family, maybe between him and one of his family members, but he won't engage. He withdraws. Crabb continues, if he was there, and there's good reason to think so, then a big question must be asked, why didn't he say anything? Before God created Eve, he had already commanded Adam to never eat from a certain tree. Adam was expected to pass on the prohibition to his wife when she appeared on the scene. And we assume he did so. But when the serpent struck up a conversation with Eve, designed to muddle her thinking about God's goodness, Adam said nothing. Yet he was listening to every word. He heard Eve misquote the command of God that he, Adam, had carefully communicated to her. He was watching when she began looking at the forbidden tree. He saw her take a step toward the tree and reach out to pluck some of its fruit. And he didn't do a thing or say one word to stop her. Adam remained silent. Later in the book, he comes back to this incident. He's like, then his silence becomes a sin. In Genesis 3:1, chaos reappears in the form of a serpent who uses deceit to confuse Adam and Eve. If Adam was there, he wasn't speaking. Chaos had entered his perfect world, and he stood dumbfounded in its confusion and darkness. Adam then was a silent man, a passive man. Like many men in history, he was physically present, but he was emotionally absent. Crabb talks about that a lot in his book, being physically present, but emotionally absent. The guy just goes through the motions. He shows up at things. He makes it to maybe your Bible study. He makes time to see people. But when he's there, he just seems distant because he's not fully there. He's physically present, but he's not fully engaged, either relationally or emotionally. He hasn't really dug in. He fades into the background of the story rather than standing front and center on the stage. His sin began with his silence. He was designed to speak, but he said nothing. He listened to the serpent. He listened to his wife. He accepted the fruit, and then he ate. Adam was passive three times before he even ate the forbidden fruit. He talks a lot in his book about the willingness of men to engage chaos, to speak into chaos, or lack thereof. He's like, men were designed to speak into like problematic situations. And yet sometimes I feel like and I want to be clear, I'm not trying to come as if I'm on this pedestal. I feel this pull too. Sometimes I feel like some guys live as if their life was a quest to avoid awkward or uncomfortable situations at all costs. And if something remotely resembling chaos comes up, there's this pull to kind of look over either shoulder and be like, sir, are you going to do something about that? I want to define a couple terms before we keep going much further. So one would be a sin of omission. So a sin of commission would be you do something that is wrong. You do something that is sinful. Maybe you say something that's hurtful. You fall into sexual sin. A sin of omission is you omit something. You don't do the thing that you should. In James 4:17, it says, to him who knows what to do but does not do it, to him it is sin. And the thing is, just knowing that verse doesn't seem to do a whole lot. I was in a home church once where I swear for a year and a half, almost every teaching, that verse was quoted, and nothing ever changed. It was almost as if we felt that if we at least quoted the verse, it made the lack of change more acceptable. This is a word I'm going to drop a lot during this. I just want to all be on the same page of what I mean by it. We talk about passivity. Accepting or allowing what happens or what others do without an active response or resistance. It's just sort of like, oh, well, that's the status quo. I guess that's just how it is. I don't know how many of you guys watch Stranger Things. One of the funniest characters but most frustrating characters in that show is the dad named Ted. Everything is falling apart around Ted throughout the show, and he just kind of is blind to all of it. Some of it he sees, and he just doesn't really do anything. Like, there's a scene at the dinner table where his kids are storming out of the room. His wife's looking at him exasperatedly, and he's just sitting there enjoying his chicken, and she's like, I hope you enjoyed your chicken, Ted. And he, like, storms out, and he's like, what'd I do? Like, what'd I do that was wrong? And it's like, that's the point. You didn't do anything. It's like, not engaging, withdrawing from it. Or maybe it's that guy who, like, looks around what we might call a ministry house here in Xenos, which is where the guys in one home church all decide to live together to help each other grow closer to God and to push each other. And you see a problem, but instead of actually dealing with it, there's this sense where it's like, what a bummer this is. The circumstances are currently less than optimal. If only there was a way for the ship to be righted here, or something like that. And I want to be clear, I definitely do believe in the Great Commission, that we should go out and make disciples of all the nations. But I think we should be realistic that to do that, that means we're going to bring in people from our culture who are already struggling with this. Men in our culture specifically are struggling a lot. And if you look at the statistics, it seems like it actually might be across the globe. In 2016, the U.S. Census Bureau found that women were outstripping men in college graduation rates. And I want to be clear, like, I'm not saying it's bad that women are graduating from college more than they used to. That's a good thing. I also, like, I don't think it's bad if a guy is like, well, I don't really know if I want to go the college route, the traditional four-year degree. I'd rather join a trade and make a good living that way. I think that's fine. I have friends that do that. But one of the things that we're seeing is there are guys who aren't pursuing the like traditional degree path, but then they're also not really going for a trade either. Just sort of floating in between dead-end jobs. This was a study that the Barna Research Group put together from 2014. And they went around and they surveyed people in different age brackets. And they asked them, with how much frequency would you say that you view pornographic material? 79% of the 18 to 30-year-olds, 38% of the 31 to 49-year-olds, and 25% of the 50 to 68-year-olds said they looked at least once a month. They asked them, how many of you would say you look at it several times a week? 63% of the 18 to 30-year-olds, 38% of the 31 to 49-year-olds, and 25% of the 50 to 68-year-olds. And this one's a dagger, too. 55% of the married men that they surveyed admitted to watching porn at least once a month. And again, these are just the people that admitted it in their survey. And I think it'd be cool if we could say, like, well, at least like when Paul commanded the Philippians to be a light against the backdrop of like that dark and perverse generation he talks about in Philippians 2, at least Christians are sort of being the standard bearers here. Not quite. Christian men are struggling too. 64% of self-identified Christian men admitted to viewing pornography at least once a month. In fact, the Pew Research Group found that women outnumber men about 55% to 45% in the church today. It's definitely something that people across the country are noticing because Christianity Today, their most recent issue, the cover story of that was titled Mending Men's Ministry. And they were talking about this phenomenon where it's like women are really starting to outnumber men in the church. And I was really excited when I saw that because I was like, maybe they'll have some good suggestions. But when I went and read the article, I was actually kind of disappointed because all they really talked about was how some groups were having success with putting the cross back into CrossFit, where they would wake up together early in the morning and work out and then pray afterwards. That was about all that they had. You think about it, that's such a different picture than what we saw with the early church. When you think about the ministry of Jesus, some men were like polarized by him, away from him, and were like repelled by him and hated him. But a lot of men were drawn to him. And there's a reason that he had to have some of those more polarizing teachings to thin down the crowds following him. People were captivated by his bold love and his bold teaching. And even after he ascended, the early church, men were a driving force in that. And somehow we've lost that. And one of the things I wanted to point out here for people that are in Xenos is like we have a great church, but we're not exempt from this either. I put together a survey that I sent out to all the college home church leaders, basically asking them a series of questions about the guys who live in their ministry houses. And when I got the results, at first I thought that maybe like the only people who responded were from like a few really struggling home churches, and that somehow like brought the results down. But then when I went back and looked, I had responses from 40 different college home churches, and the leaders who responded, over half of them were what we would call the senior leader, so the one who is sort of like helping the other leaders grow. And if it wasn't the senior leader, most of them were people who'd been leading in home churches for several years. 63% of them estimated that at least a quarter of the guys in their ministry house watch porn at least monthly. Again, these are the guys in the ministry house. These aren't like people that like just like came to know Christ a week ago and still have all of these like old habits they're trying to kick. These are guys that are like, I really do want to follow God. 20% estimated that at least half of the guys in their ministry house watch porn at least monthly. Almost everybody estimated that the average guy in their ministry house is on an IT device, so like a tablet or a phone, gaming, each day for at least 1 hour, not counting time for work or for school, which is like you hear that and it's like, okay, like 1 hour, it's like it's not that bad. 80% estimated it was at least 2 hours. And almost a third of them said that the average guy in their ministry house spent at least 3 hours a day on that. So a little bit about myself, I'm trying to relearn Spanish, and then my wife grew up in Cambodia, so I'm trying to learn Cambodian, extremely, extremely, extremely basic Cambodian. And so I went online at the Foreign Language Institute's website, and they basically have like an estimate of here's how many hours it takes to learn a different language. If you spent 3 hours a day for a year learning a language, you would be fluent in Spanish, and two-thirds of the way there in Norwegian. And that's how much time almost a third of the leaders said the average guy in their ministry house spends on that stuff. I also asked them, I gave them a list of basically seven frequently cited obstacles that they see to guys in their ministry houses building a personal ministry where either they're mentoring someone or just in general like giving out serving love. I purposely did not put apathy on there. Because I wanted to actually get at what the root of that apathy is. And here's how they rank them on average. By far, the highest was video games and computer games. By far, the lowest was lack of Bible knowledge. And I thought that was interesting. Lack of Bible knowledge by far was the lowest, and then lack of basic relational skills was also pretty far down there as well. And one of the things I thought was interesting about that was that sometimes I think that when people think of a guy who's passive or is struggling to build a personal ministry, it's easy to think of the guy who's like, I don't know, 100 pounds overweight or has some sort of in-your-face, outlandish, off-putting thing. But what this seemed to suggest was that these were people who were able to have normal conversations. These weren't guys who like had no sense of like social skills. These were guys who were like normal everyday guys who definitely know enough that their leaders are like, this guy is more than capable of doing work for God. But then the output wasn't there. And so what I want to spend the rest of this time doing is basically looking through three different categories. I want this to be extremely practical. And we're going to go through some areas to check, basically like blind spots to make sure that you're not missing. Internal principles and motivating slow-moving guys that seem to have been helpful, and then just some practical ideas. First area to check, do we consistently have good teachings? Like when you think about the average teaching at your home church or in one of your cell groups, is it good? Is it engaging? Is it boring? If it's bad, you're basically handicapping one of the best weapons you have in your arsenal for motivating change. The Word of God, the ministry of the Word. It really is a sin to make the Word of God boring. You think about it, if your teachings are making some of these concepts boring, what does that communicate to the people you're trying to persuade? It's like if you aren't even excited about the thing that you're trying to get them to do, why should they be? Do we consistently have good teachings? How badly are the dudes in porn? And no, I did not ask, do you think the guys are in porn? I asked how badly. And if your answer to that is, I don't really know. You don't really talk about it. You should start there, especially if you lead in a high school group. If you're trying to mentor a guy who's in high school and you're wondering, why is it that this guy just does not seem to have a lot going on when it comes to spiritual thoughts? The vast majority of the time, it's because he's entrenched in porn. And I also want to make a quick case here for it. Sometimes people hear this and they're like, well, so-and-so wouldn't do that. Like this guy that I've been mentoring for a while, he wouldn't do that. We've talked about it before, about why it's wrong. We've had a teaching on it like a year ago. Or maybe a parent's like, well, my son wouldn't do that. Statistically, they definitely would. In 2016, Pornhub, at the end of the year, Pornhub's this website, sort of is like a celebration of a big year for them. They released like a year in review of statistics. 4,599,000 hours of porn were watched on just their website. To put that in perspective, they went ahead and converted that into years. 526,641 years of porn were watched on just their website. That's 2.5 times longer than Homo sapiens have been on Earth. In 2007, again, this isn't like Fox News or Christianity Today, the Journal of Adolescent Research put together a study where they surveyed 813 adolescents, and they asked them, how often would you say that you look at porn? 21% said that they look at it every day or almost every day, which it's like, okay, that's a lot. But there's still like 80% that aren't. An additional 21% said they viewed it 2 to 3 days a week. And it's like, maybe you're like a super optimist and you're like, that's still less than half. An additional 27% said they looked at it 1 to 2 days a week. And you think about it, that was in 2007. That was when the first iPhone was coming out. I would imagine that in the decades since then, as smartphones have gotten more and more developed and it's gotten easier and easier to access some of this stuff, and more people have smartphones, it would at least be similar. Sometimes when people hear it, they're like, okay, like porn's probably not good, but why is that such a difference maker when it comes to someone's spirituality? So these two scientists, they basically did a study where they looked at the human brain, and they found that the more that someone was looking at porn, there was a correlation between that and then them having less gray matter in their brain. And as far as why that matters, gray matter is basically the reward center of the brain. So it's like when you do something, like you achieve a goal, or you get the satisfaction of a job well done, or you lead someone to Christ, that portion of your brain is what's supposed to fire and basically reward you. If you have less of that, you don't get as much of a positive response from some of those things. So as far as the brain chemistry, that's part of why it makes a difference. The things that should motivate you, that the reward that you should get, that feeling of satisfaction you get from doing ministry, it just doesn't fire. Another area to check, have I tried different approaches? And I've got a couple of different qualifiers for this. Or am I trying the same thing over and over again and hoping it produces different results? If you've confronted this guy 5 times now on why he should change, in a certain area, and he hasn't, you should probably try something else. It doesn't seem to be working. Another one, are you trying different approaches, or are we assuming that the same things that would motivate me, or the same pitch that maybe motivated this other guy, are going to be motivating to this one? I don't like it when people use like the temperaments, like whether you're like a phlegmatic, like laid back person, a choleric, melancholy, sanguine. I don't like when people use those as an excuse for their sin habit. But there is something to be said that the same kind of pitch that really fired up your sanguine friend's emotions won't necessarily motivate your phlegmatic, super logically thinking friend to follow God. You might have to change your approach a little bit there. Is the problem with this specific guy? Or is our group's ethos the problem? Is it a bigger issue than that? What I mean by that is sometimes, like, I've said and I've heard people say things like, man, this guy that I'm mentoring, he can't get someone out to one of our teachings to hear the word of God taught. If he got someone there, then we'd be in business and I could really help this guy get off the ground with trying to mentor someone else. But he's just not getting them out. And so what I'm trying to get out here is the problem just with this guy, or do you have a bigger group-wide health problem that you're missing by micro-focusing on this one guy? Urban Meyer is an incredible football coach, but one of the things that sets him apart, according to his colleagues and his peers, is he's an incredible motivator. He has a really good sense of where are people at, what's going to move them forward, and he wrote a book called Above the Line where he details how did he build a championship team a few years ago. He says, ironically, some coaches are so preoccupied with pushing for results that they fail to build a culture that sustains behavior that produces results. But winning behavior will not thrive in a culture that doesn't support it. As a leader, you are responsible for creating a winning culture that that drives behavior and produces winning results. It's not someone else's job. It's yours. Yeah, winning culture is created, according to him. It doesn't just happen. Sometimes I think people are like, well, like, people in this group, like, it just seems like the attitude is that we don't care. It's like, as a leader, that's your job. You set the tone. He says, exceptional leaders create a culture that engages hearts and minds, energizes action, and executes with discipline. When that happens, the numbers and wins follow. Culture eats strategy for lunch. Talent, schemes, tactics, and plans, they can't replace a strong culture. A great culture can make even a mediocre strategy successful, but a weak culture will undermine even the best strategy. There might be something to think about. Maybe God is holding off on bringing people out to your group on purpose, because maybe the atmosphere at some of your meetings is so dead that if someone came out, they would hear a boring teaching where no one participates in it, so it seems like no one wants to be there, and afterwards no one would welcome them, no one would engage them about a spiritual topic. And so maybe God's like, you should work on some of those group-wide health things, and then I'll send people. Right now, if I bring this dude out, he's never coming back. Another area to check. Are you friends with them? And I mean that in a couple of different ways. For one, do they view themselves as being a part of your own life? One of the reasons that's helpful is that when they actually get to know you and what kind of a person that you are, when you bring something up to them, they know you well enough that they're able to say, like, he really does mean what he says. Like, he wouldn't bring this up if he didn't actually mean it. In addition to that, it's not just that you mean what you say, but that you actually care about them, and that's why you're saying it. Have you tried building some common interests and memories? It's important. If you're trying to come at someone as like a spiritual taskmaster that meets with them every week to tell them what to do, they're probably not going to listen to you. Even Jesus himself said, I've called you friends. Here are some pictures of some of the guys that I've studied with over the years. These are some of like the most fun things that we've done together. And as you can see, in none of these is Burkhoff systematic theology open. In this one, me and Dean are taking off someone's head with a dodgeball. In a couple of these, we're at the beach. In that one, we're at the Liberty Bell because we drove to Philadelphia to see a crew game and slept in a Walmart parking lot overnight. But I think like the advantage is that like we have some of those things to fall back on. So if they're frustrated that I brought something up, they know he's not saying this because he hates me. Like, he really does, like, care about me. He views me as more than a project. Do they know how to do what you expect them to do? Now, to be fair, that earlier survey suggested that the issue with the vast majority of guys is not a lack of equipping. But that is what their leaders think. Sometimes leaders assume that their guy knows how to do something, and they're surprised. They're like, what do you mean you didn't know how to interpret that passage? We're like, what do you mean you didn't know how to do this? So this would be an area. On a personal note, I remember my senior year of high school, Tim, actually in the back, asked me, he was like, all right, pretend that I wasn't a Christian and try and give me the gospel and lead me to Christ. And I don't remember exactly what came out of my mouth, but the painful, stammering, incoherent blubbering that did was definitely not the gospel. But he showed me the Romans Road, and he was like, if you show these verses, it's able to explain to people, here's why you need Jesus. Here's how you receive Jesus. And it was really empowering. I think I shared my faith more in the next 6 months than I had in the previous 2 years, because I knew if they asked me questions about how do I actually accept Christ, I could tell them. One of the best teachers is letting them see you do it. One of the guys that I studied with, we'd read books on how to share your faith. We made goals every week. We talked about it a lot. But I feel like the thing he learned the most from was like a 15-minute conversation I had with a Hindu friend of his who he was bringing out. And afterwards, we were able to go back and I was able to be like, so what'd you think about that? Did you see how we were able, because of these questions, to keep things focused on the gospel? We didn't get sidetracked on all of these tangential issues. Why do you think we didn't ask that? Why do you think we waited to ask this one? Let them see you do it. Deeper relating. For one, sometimes I think when people tell guys, you should have like really cool, deep, vulnerable conversations, it's like you're not even speaking the same language. you might have to teach them to like describe their thoughts and their feelings on something beyond tired, angry, and hungry. So you might have to help them there. Also, it's helpful to make sure that they know how to ask good questions. Like role playing is good here. Like ask them, like, okay, like imagine I'm like a new guy at home church, or I'm one of your roommates. Get into a spiritual conversation with me. And one of the things I realized when I was doing this with my guys a couple years ago is that they were fine once they were in the deep conversation. It was getting there. And so we started working on stuff where like, I was like, okay, so you just start with what you see and get to a spiritual conversation from there. And we looked over and there's a guy in a baseball jersey. And I was like, okay, so that guy likes baseball. Well, maybe you ask him, so you like baseball. Well, how'd you get into that? It's like, oh, like you and your dad used to play catch a lot. So you and your dad, you're pretty tight then, right? And it's like, well, maybe they say like, yeah, we are, we were. And it's like, well, then you're there. It's deeper. Just kind of walk them through how to get from A to B. Friendship skills. And I don't just mean the deep ones. I mean like the initial friendship building, like the small talk where you're talking about sports or movies or hobbies. And I think that a lot of guys have a hard time with this. And I would imagine that more and more guys will have a harder time with this because more and more guys, their primary source of relational interaction is with the screen and not a person. And I also make a plug here for this book by Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People. Super helpful. Really practical. Pretty humorous. Really blunt. And it's all about like things like, you know, if you try and like explain to someone why they should listen to you, but you're like this the whole time, they're not going to listen to you. When you talk about what you're excited about, smile. Things like that. Really practical, really helpful. Do they feel supported by you? For one, with their ministry. So in some of those pictures that I showed, like at the Liberty Bell, we were there with the guy that the dude I study with was studying with. In some of those other pictures, the guys that they were trying to mentor were in the vicinity. I remember a few years ago, one of the other guys on staff here, Josh Benedict, made a point where he was like, you should view your disciples' disciples as yours. And he was referencing two of the guys that he had mentored and the best guy that each of them had won into a discipleship relationship. And he was like, to be fair, like my guys like did like a good amount of work there, but a lot of it was by me. Like I helped them out a lot. And I want my guys to know that if they bring someone out, that I'll have their back, that I'm going to welcome that guy, that I'll try and help him. Like I might try and hit that guy up on my own to hang out with him. And if that guy has some questions that are tougher, then I'm down to help him answer those. Do they also feel supported by you with their goals? And what I mean by that is, do they feel like you're trying to push your own agenda onto their life? A good question to ask is, so like, where do you want to be in 5 years? In 1 year? What do you want out of your relationship with God in 6 months? How can I help you get there? Do I have a vision for my disciple? Or do I believe in them? If you don't, you should pray through that, because they will definitely notice. I remember there was a guy in my college group probably 3 or 4 years ago who was very difficult for a lot of people to love, including myself. And I remember one of the things he encouraged one of the other leaders on was, he was like, one of the things I really appreciated about you was that I felt like you believed in me. And I was like, that's cool that he encouraged the other leader on that, but it was sort of a punch in the gut to me. Because it was like, he definitely picked up that I didn't believe in him. Maybe even more importantly than do you have a vision is, do they know that you have a vision for them? Don't let yourself think, well, yeah, of course they know. They might not. They might actually be really insecure about what you think. They also might have hidden talents that they didn't know that they had. Or they might be doing things that they don't realize how sweet it is what they're doing. Tell them. The disparity between the encouraging things that we think and the encouraging things that we say is usually really vast. I probably should have had this one first. Did they get time with God? If they aren't, you're fighting a losing battle because it's you against their hardened heart. Another thing to check with this would be, when they get time with God, are they actually connecting with God? Do they voice something that they're like, God showed me this, and so I'm going to act on it? Or is it like they're reading a dead textbook? Have other people tried speaking into this area of their life? If you haven't had this maddening experience, then you will at some point, where this guy comes to you and they're like, wow, he just told me something I've never heard before. I've never even considered this. And you're like, what is it? And it's like, he told me that if I don't read my Bible, I won't grow spiritually. And you're just like, ah, like what we've been doing every week for the last like 5 years. And so there's something to be said for that. Like if you don't have to always be the one that tells them, someone else could go in and tell them the same thing and it might register more. So next, I want to talk through some internal principles in motivating slow-moving guys. And one thing I want to start off with is that there's a difference in saying this guy is just apathetic and this guy's unmotivated. I feel like sometimes people are like, he's just an apathetic guy, he just doesn't care. And if you say that, it's sort of like you're attributing that to him as an inherent quality of his life. It's like saying, well, Doug's just 6'1 and has brown eyes. But that's not going to change, it's kind of the way it is. And if you say that about someone, it's like they're just apathetic, they don't care, they're not going to change. You're sort of like at a loss of what to do then. But if you view it as like this guy's unmotivated, then it puts the ball back into your hands. Because it's like, okay, like they're unmotivated, how do we try and motivate them? For one, everyone is motivated by something. That guy that spends 3 hours a day playing League of Legends or plays Madden until 4 in the morning, he gets something out of that. There's some reason that he keeps coming back to that. What is it? Is it significance? Like, does he feel important when he does that? If so, tailor your pitch towards that. It's like, don't you know that you have important work to do here? In Ephesians 2, it says that God created good works so that we would walk in them. Maybe it's a sense of community, respect, whatever it is, try and figure it out. And then pitch following God along those lines. Get at the fear of failure. I've heard it said that the most repeated phrase or command in the Bible is do not fear. And I don't know if that's actually true or not, but I will say that behind a lot of guys' inactivity is a fear of trying something and failing. And I feel like a lot of guys are trapped in this cycle where they're afraid of trying something and screwing it up. They're so paralyzed by that fear that they never try it. And then as a result, they fail to achieve that goal that they originally wanted. And then it just keeps going onward and onward. Try and get in there and break that cycle. It's like, okay, like you're worried about screwing this up. All right, what if you do? Then what? It's like, well, you'd still have grace and God would still be all powerful and in control. So the odds are you wouldn't have done irreparable damage. So get at the fear of failure. You can break that cycle. Dispel the lies and misconceptions that men have about following God. I mean, things like following God is boring or for like uptight people or something like that. Like I want my guys to know that it's full of adventure and that it's exhilarating, or that following God is for the weak and feminine or something like that. I read a quote in this book, Why Men Hate Going to Church. And David Murrow made a point. He's like, a wise Texan once told me that men don't go to church because they've been to one before. And I think a good question to ask someone, especially if they've recently come to Christ and they're considering, should I follow God or not with my life? A good clarifying question is, what do you think I have in mind when I talk about following God? What do you think that means? What do you think I do? And then you can basically debunk a lot of those. Be direct and straightforward when confronting. Murrow points out that a lot of guys, he feels that their love language is confronting one another and challenging one another. Says that men have this innate drive and desire to be great, and that when they're reasonably and respectfully given feedback on how to become great, they eat it up. The other thing, too, is that guys can tell when you're vaguely disapproving of something they do. It's like if you ask, so did you read your Bible this week? And they're like, no. And you're just like, okay. They definitely understand that you're not happy about that. Just be direct. They'll end up respecting you more. And they're way more likely to actually do what you want than if you take this indirect bank shot because you actually told them, this is what I want you to do. Just be straightforward about it. Urban Meyer talks about this scene after he took over OSU's team where Zach Boren and Etienne Sabino came to him and they told him, all right, look, we're not playing well. The reason we're not playing well is because you're working us too hard. So he puts his pencil down. He's quiet for a minute. He wants to clarify his thoughts and evaluate the situation before he responds. So he looks hard at both of them and he tells them, no, I will tell you why we're not playing well. It's because we have a selfish, lazy team that complains all the time. We lack leadership. I told you to trust the plan, and you need to do it now. I didn't hear another word from Zach or Etienne or anybody else. In fact, both of those guys emerged as tremendous leaders for our team. Another thing I'd say, passion helps. People are drawn to passionate leaders. Guys want a cause to fight for. If you're talking about how sweet it is to follow God, don't pitch it as this muted thing that you're kind of ambivalent about. That's kind of cool or something like that. Like, I remember there was a guy a few years ago, we were reading a chapter about heaven, and it was like I was listening to Eeyore. It's like,
the streets are paved with gold. It is awesome.
It's such a walking contradiction. But then you have stories like John Lennox tells about when Billy Graham would come to preach, and he would see his atheist friends taking off to go hear him. And he was like, why are you guys going to hear him? Like, do you believe what he's teaching? And they're like, no, but he does. People are drawn to that, where they're like, man, he really, really believes what he's teaching. Here's one, what you tolerate is what you get. People say stuff sometimes like, our ministry house keeps sleeping through prayer group. No one speaks up. No one shares during our teachings. Well, wake them up. Call on them. It's like you can push things a little bit more. Murrow says, make things too comfortable for a man and he'll lose interest. Try to control him. He'll rebel. Over-confront him. He'll resent you as a nag. But challenge him the way Jesus challenged the disciples and he'll grow. A church that challenges its members is a church where men can thrive. That's a good point. Use positive and negative vision. A few years ago, I was in this group where like it was really stagnant and nothing was happening, or so it seemed. And I think one of the most like erroneous statements I've made as a leader was when I was like, all right, in exasperation, I was like, I guess we just have to keep confronting them until they change. And in hindsight, it's like that old pirate saying of like, beatings will continue until morale improves. So you can couple it with both. It's like, don't be predictable. They probably expect you to confront them. You can say stuff like, you know, you could be like this guy if you just got over this. And then you can bring in the negative vision of like, but if you don't, this is where you could end up. Dudes can't feel like they're wasting their potential or their time. Guys always like talking about how they found a bargain. Guys like to brag about like the sweet deal they got on a car or the best deal that they got on food, whatever. I want my guys to know that they found the investment that other people missed, that this is the wisest investment of their lives and the best usage of their potential. Urban Meyer has a point where he's like, he puts up posters of all the players in the NFL that came out of Ohio State in each of the coaches' offices. Because he's like, when they go into the offensive lineman's office, I want them to know they're learning from a master of his craft. And so then there's a cool point there. If you can hype people's disciples and their leaders up to each other, I'm like, you know, you're really lucky to like learn from that guy, right? He's a great counselor, or he really knows the Bible well. Like, you're lucky that he's teaching you. Make sure they feel respected and valued. That old adage is true, that men want respect. Make sure their contributions are noticed. They should leave your time feeling excited that you view them as a like legit member of the people of God, the army of God. You don't want them leaving your time with their tail between their legs, shell-shocked from this barrage of admonition you just gave them. People tend towards settling. Find ways to shake things up. A.W. Tozer has a point he drags out of Genesis where he says, all right, men were made from the dust, right? And dust has a tendency to settle. So therefore, people have a tendency to settle. And whatever you think about that usage of that verse to justify that, anecdotally, it seems to be true that people tend to regress towards the mean. So change things up from time to time. Don't wait until your group is already in a rut to try and do something about it. It could be as little as just the way you set up your meeting, what you study, where you study. We did something where we felt like our prayer group was dead. And so we were like, all right, we're going to collect prayer requests from a bunch of different foreign missions groups, all the high school groups, our college groups affiliated with, and our church as a whole. And we're going to see if we can pray the whole night. And if you can't make it, that's fine. But like, at least try and make it to like one or two. And our people loved it. Like afterwards, they were so excited about that. They're like, can we get the prayer list from that? That was really cool. We want to keep praying for those things. It really reinvigorated our prayer group. Go off their deeds, not just their words. I feel like the epitaph on a lot of people's discernments, if you were to put it on a gravestone, is he went off the good talk. Jesus tells that parable. He's like, there's two brothers. One of them, when their father asked him to help, he said no, but then he helped him. And the other one said, yeah, I'll help you, but then he didn't help him. Which one of them actually was helpful? So it's like the one who actually did it. And so I think it's okay to tell people, look, I believe you. I really want to believe you. Prove me right. I believe you, but you got to back it up. Be proactive, not reactive. You should preach against things like the world system or preach against marathon gaming ahead of time. It's a bad sign if you're running around. It's a bad sign for your leadership if you're constantly running around putting out fires. Try and get ahead of the eight ball a little bit there. Compliance or agreeing isn't the same thing as being persuaded. Some people hate tension so much that they will say literally whatever they can or whatever they think they need to end that conversation. And with people like that, you might need to dig in a little bit further in that conversation to make sure that the point actually got through, that they're not just placating you and deflecting the issue or something like that. And lastly, well-behaved doesn't equal radical. Sometimes I think that guys can settle for being ahead of the least spiritual, most unseemly, disruptive, outlandish dude in their group. And they're like, well, I'm better than him, so I'm doing something right. I think it's important to remind people that's not the bar. That's not the same as growing spiritually. Well-behaved doesn't equal actually growing for God. What about some practical ideas? Think and pray about them outside of your time. You got to get God's perspective on this person and their potential strengths and a renewed vision. Come ready. Ask God for some questions to ask him, some topics to discuss. Don't come into that time and be like, well, just let the Spirit lead on this one. So actually come and ready to go. Make that time sweet. Help them build friendships. If you can get them getting together with a guy or two consistently who isn't their discipler, that's huge. That's really, really big. That's such a safeguard for them actually making it their whole life with God, is that they have friends that when you're not there anymore, will challenge them. I'd also say a thing about helping guys build friendships, using examples like military examples are really helpful. Like showing a clip of Band of Brothers and being like, you see how he was willing, what he was willing to do for that guy over there? That's like what Jesus is calling us to do. It says there's no greater love than this than to lay your life down for your friends. And to be fair, some guys are more emotional than others, but I think the majority of the time, if someone thinks that to have a Christian friendship with another guy means that he has to cry into his arms all the time, you're probably fighting a losing battle. And so you can pitch things like making it sound more like heroic. Hold up good models. There's all sorts of models, even within your own like small group. Make sure that they know which ones are good and which ones are bad. It's biblical. Paul did that. Talk through with them. Like, okay, so like, why do you think people like respect this guy so much? What do you think so cool about him? Or like, so that guy over there, like, what'd you think about what he did? I thought that was actually pretty lame. Here's why. Talk through that stuff with them. Keep the bar high on content that you study. Keep it stimulating. Especially for guys who you really think have that higher capacity to really handle deeper stuff. Sometimes I think this is a good safeguard to keep people from being sucked into like an over-pursuit of school. Because they realize that what Francis Schaeffer said is true, that Christianity is the greatest intellectual system the human mind has ever touched. You don't need to get that from school. You already have it. That's the thing that's really going to like sharpen you mentally. Keep the bar high. Present things with a sense of patriotism. What I mean by that is, all right, in this group of people, we are not going to be like that. This is what we are going to be about. In this group, we will make sacrifices to get time together. That might mean that we show up early. That might mean that we stay late. Other groups in our country may be willing to compromise on some of the Bible's more controversial truths. We will not. I also think it's good to get your guys to be excited about how good their home church is. Last fall, winter, I was talking with some of our guys, and we were like, all right, we are in one of the best student ministries in the world. And we are in one of the best home churches in that student ministry. So they can be excited about that. They're a part of that. It'll make them more excited to bring their friends out to it. Do fun stuff together. As Christians, we have the freedom to have fun. Do you embody that? Because if you don't, then you're giving evidence to one of the most widely held lies about Christianity, that God is this big fun sucker. A lot of my favorite memories with my guys were watching sports, blowing things up, hitting one of them with the dodgeball. Do fun stuff together. Take them with you during your time where you meet up to serve somebody. It won't kill you to use the last hour of your study time to be, okay, let's go pick up this guy in our group. And let's brainstorm ahead of time of like, what are some good questions we could ask this guy? And when you do it the first time, you might do 90% of the work. But afterwards, you can go and be like, dude, that what you did, that was sweet. You did that. That was awesome. You really encouraged them for their part. And they're like, okay, now you go do it by yourself next week. Address pornography. I really can't emphasize enough. They aren't going to grow very much spiritually without this. Don't let them get away with Christian euphemisms. Sometimes I think people say, like, if they put like Christian churchy language on their sin habit, that it somehow makes it more excusable or makes it better. Someone's like, well, I'm just passive. I'm just a people pleaser. That's why I don't do such and such a thing. And I think there's a point where if you get the sense that they're really too comfortable with having that problem, you can say things like, wait, you know that like being a people pleaser means that you care more about what so-and-so thinks about you than God, right? And like, I'm not advocating for like being like a cop where you basically like examine everything that they say. But there is a time and place where like you can tell someone that if you think that they like are like trying just to like push it off to the side and not actually deal with it. This was an idea I stole from Urban Meyer called The Grind, where they have a portion of their gym where after they finish their practices and their workouts, there's this place called The Grind where the players who really want to excel can go to get extra practice. And so some of my friends and I were talking about, what does it look like to implement something like that in our home church? One of them started a book club for people in his group where he was like, if you don't want to do this, that's totally fine. But this book is sweet. And if you want to read it, we're going to talk about it when we have our meetings. It could be something else. Like I remember my first couple years in the college group, I knew that the best fellowship I would have with my leaders would happen after 1 a.m. And so I knew it was worth it to stick around and stay late. And I'm not saying it has to be until 1 a.m. Maybe you can't do that. But I think it's fair to tell people, like, you know that like the best fellowship usually happens after things die down a bit after our teachings, right? And after some of the newer people leave. You should stick around for that. You would really like that. Dudes retreat, great for unity and spiritual conversations. Some of the guys, we took our high school group on one a few years ago. They still talk about how much fun they had playing roof ball in the rain for 2 hours. And then we had to stop because a tornado was touching down and we could see it. So we had to go hide. Our sphere, so basically our portion of high school groups that are sort of affiliated with each other, is taking all of the upperclassmen high school guys on basically a man retreat this fall. And we're going to do teachings on what it means to be a spiritual man, and we're going to eat a bunch of bacon and do a bunch of stuff like that. It should be really cool. Move the gaming systems out of the living room. This, you'd be surprised how much of a deterrent this is from people playing them all the time. For some people, the extra effort to walk up a flight of stairs or two really is like insurmountable. It also keeps people from believing, well, I'm in the same room as the guys talking to each other, so that's got to count for like relating, right? And then the guys who like aren't the like diehard hardcore gamers, they don't get sucked into it because they're not around it. Talk about your own evangelism and convictions. People do what you do, not what you say. So talk about people that you're trying to reach, things that you're learning. It'll make your calls for them to do the same ring less hollowly. Encourage any progress. This is big. Don't overlook this, especially after you confront them. I can really tell that you're trying here. I think it's interesting that in the Bible, it's like when you confront, if something happens, be willing to admonish them. But then it's encourage one another day by day as long as it can still be called today. It's like the difference in frequency there is definitely clear. Don't waste relational capital on small issues. You'll lose your hearing very quickly on more important ones. If you're not sure if that's your tendency or not, ask someone. They'll tell you. Outreach events geared towards men. Sports. beer tastings. We did an all-night marathon of Stranger Things the night it came out. Just tailor the things that you do to the people you're trying to reach. They'll come. Heroism. It's one thing to tell someone you should share your faith. It's another thing to tell them, did you know that one of the most heroic things you can do is to tell someone about Christ? It's one thing to tell a guy, you should really love this guy. It's another thing to say, like, are you willing to lay down your life for your friends? It's more compelling. Murrow says, did Christ come to tame men or set them free? Is Jesus looking for docile men or wild men? John Eldridge notes, I think most men in the church believe God put them on the earth to be a good boy. If churchgoing held the prospect of risk, adventure, and daring, you'd have an abundance of men, teenagers, and young adults signing up. That's precisely what we find in the persecuted church today. It was also the situation in the early church, when Christians were routinely stoned, beaten, or fed to hungry lions. When it's dangerous to be a Christian, men are more likely to count themselves in. It's definitely true. Last one, stories about other people are really good. I think some people are too abstract. It's helpful for people to say, you know this guy who teaches every week? He actually was pretty similar spot to you at one point. Or like, you know that guy you really look up to? He had to start somewhere. They got over these couple things, and that's where they ended up. You could do that. Biographies are really cool. I like talking with my guys about Dietrich Bonhoeffer and some of the things that he did. It's like, hearing things like that, they're like, man, like, I didn't know Christians were, like, could do things like that. I didn't know Christians were allowed to, like, be involved in the plot to, like, assassinate Hitler. Biblical characters are cool. Reading the Hall of Faith is sweet. That line where it says, these were men of whom the world was not worthy. Guys hear that and they're like, that's cool. I would like to be a guy of whom the world is not worthy. A fun after cell group activity, read epic passages of the Bible. This guy did this. It was sweet. He went into a pit on a snowy day and killed a lion. Some conclusions. For one, Jesus intends to draw men to himself. He did it in his earthly ministry. He did it after he ascended. And we have the same Bible. We have the same gospel. We have the same Holy Spirit. It's definitely doable. Secondly, men are capable of standing by idly while chaos goes on, but they will also jump headlong into chaos if they're motivated. The guys in your home church are definitely capable of either one of these. And if you don't believe that, you should pray about that with God. Don't let yourself think, well, this guy's just apathetic. Fight for him. God entrusted this person to you. Fight for him. And lastly, one thing I'll say is men won't respond to a textbook as much as they will to a leader that's charging ahead of them. I think a good question to reflect on for yourself is like, are you setting the pace? Are you setting the standard and you're charging ahead and you're calling people forward with you? Or are you chilling in the back basically saying, you should do that. Go and do that. Well, cool. Well, if you have more things you want to talk about, I'll stick around afterwards, but I'll go ahead and pray for us. God, I'm definitely thankful that you really do intend to draw all men to yourself. Pray that things that people heard today, if there are a few points that resonated with them, that they wouldn't just forget them, but that it would result in real change, and that it would result in people coming to know you, but then also following you. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.